Major Christ, a real threat. So you were telling me about the parachuters in Grantham.
Yeah, well, that got a bit tedious. So I went up to London and saw, I think Colonel, I think it must have been Colonel Carlton Smith, his name was, who had originally recruited me for the Jeds.
You mean you went to see him at your own request?
That's right, because I came to the conclusion really that I'd be safer in a jungle than I was in Grantham. It was really quite impossible. So, and that's right. And about a week later, I found myself on board a ship, going out to Bombay to join Force 136, as it was called. And
So was he delighted to get you, or did he have to be persuaded?
no, I was just, no, that was it. I think several of the other Jeds, they'd gone straight on, I think, without all this trauma of the airborne forces business. Yes, that's right, that's how it was. And then from there, went by train down to Ceylon, and they had a camp at a place called Horana outside, and it was in the middle of a coconut plantation about, I don't know, 30 miles outside of Colombo. I found difficulty there, because the day after I got there, there was a truck, there was a little passion wagon that went into Colombo. So I went in on that, and I was a bit late getting back. I missed the truck getting back at midnight. So I got a taxi, and I had to try and explain to it where I was. And I couldn't remember the name of the place. I knew it right the day before. I knew it was in the middle of a coconut plantation. So it was about 3 hours of touring all the coconut plantations. I got back there safely. I then spent a week, I suppose, in Colombo. That wasn't all that amusing because it was very, very hot, and you couldn't ever swim anywhere. You weren't allowed to swim in the sea because they said there were sharks. And the hotels or the clubs had swimming bars, but all the sort of high brass of the army, they were all sort of, I'm saying, us only, members only. However, I used to nip in very quick and might take my clothes off and then get into the swimming bath, and so that wasn't too bad, and get a free swim night again. So then I was flown up from Colombo. I think we always fly going out, and you can't come back by train. Flew up to Calcutta, and I was in Force 136 was divided up there, different country sections. There's one for Burma, and I suppose there's one for Malaya, and there's one for French Indochina, I suppose it was. Burma was the one I was in. And I was teamed up then with a chap called Hugo Hood, who had been a Jed, and he's dead now. He's a schoolmaster, funny chap. He was a major. I was then a captain, and there was a very good radio operator, Royal Corps Signals, a little weaselly chap, Scotsman, called Jock Rourke. Very nice chap and a very good signaller. That's right, and we took off then from Jessore Airport. That's now in Bangladesh, actually, just. I suppose it's about 20 or 30 miles out of Calcutta. We took off. There was another team. I think there was another team in our aircraft. And as soon as there was another aircraft, because we looked back, we saw it on fire, which wasn't very encouraging. I think they were all burnt up, actually. I don't know who they were, but it must be known who they were. And what sort of date we're talking about now? It must be, I don't know, it must be February, I suppose, February 45 by now. I don't know exactly. And we dropped in Burma, just south of Tangu, which is, I think it's on the Sitang River. And I can't remember an awful lot right away. We were taken off into the woods. I remember sitting there. They were
You
very,
met up with a reception
oh
party.
yes, reception party. I think just our team. But the other lot may have been dropped somewhere else. I'm not sure. I think it was us. And then they're very quick at making bamboo constructions always out there. And they made little sort of bamboo platforms. I sat on a bamboo platform for about a couple of days. Hugo Hood was there too. He was the boss. And then we were hanging around because it was just the time the Burmese National Army was meant to be coming over to our side. Burmese National Army, you know, they were sort of Jap trained or started. And they're meant to be coming over to our side. And there was a chap called Thakin Thantun. I think I got that right. You have the advantage of me here because you hear all these other stories that I don't know about. But anyway, he was obviously biding his time a little bit and had orders. Then we had orders at one of us, so I went to another party of ours, which was up in the woods, maybe 20 miles away. So we went there by night in a bullock cart, lying down the back of it. It was dry season across the paddy fields, and there's a bag bun between each paddy field and the old ox cart thing. Up on the bank and down again. You went down with a tremendous bang that sort of shook every bone in your body. And so we went across to this other, but up in the woods then, to this other team, maybe 20 miles away, and there's a chap called Tom Carew. He became a regular army officer. I think he's still alive. And there's a fellow called Bill Brown, who was a very, very odd character. He'd been a Jed too. Arrived there, I found them all busy.
In what way odd?
What? Well, erratic. When I got up in this woods there, they said, "Welcome to Silver Foxhole," and there they were busy playing poker. They always played poker, these chaps. With all these phony chips we had, Burmese money we were given, they were at it. They were all sitting around. Bill Brown, he'd been caught a few days earlier. He'd been caught by the Sikh police. They were very tedious. I think British always employed someone outsiders to police the Burmese, and these Sikhs, they'd gone over to the Japs rather, I think. And Bill Brown had been tied up by his wrists, but he got away somehow. He said what he said. And we sat around there for about another day. And then Thantun turned up. Thantun, Thakin Thantun. And he had a bit of a beard, rather a measly beard they have. And then we got the orders. So we could, our lot, we were called Zebra. That was the name of my party, Zebra. We were to move over to the other side of the country, go across the Piguyomas. So we started back to where Hugo Hood was and I suppose the radio operator, Jock Rourke. It took us most of the night to get back. It was the moon, I remember. And then the moon went down. I don't know why it should. And it was very dark. And the locals said they couldn't move in the dark anymore. We had to wait till the moon rose. That was it, I think. I think the moon hadn't risen. That was it. It got dark, I suppose, and they couldn't see how to go. And I, by some luck or other, we were given some Benzedrine pills meant to keep you awake. I took some of these Benzedrine pills, and I stayed awake. Because then the moon rose, and we were all lying around in the open there. And I was the only one awake, which was very lucky, really, because I gave everybody else a good kick, you know, and got the show on the road again. I always reckon people complain about drugs and how it kills them. I reckon that it saved our lives, really, because they were very, very addictive, I think, because we only had a certain number of pills, and you could walk along and you would walk on air. You wouldn't feel any hard work of carrying anything or anything else. It's absolutely marvelous. Of course, they ran out, of course, really, just as well. Because otherwise, I think I might have been addicted to them for life, perhaps. So then we set off across the Piguyamas. So Piguyamas are the hills that go down like a spine, down the middle there. And I had no idea how far it was, maybe in 100 miles. It was up and down, up and down, up and down, through bamboo woods, jungle, I suppose they call it. And but the occasional tree, you know, they have the teak. They're growing clumps of teak. They have one teak tree there and one teak there, you know. And it was really quite an adventure up and down. It was very, very hard work. We had these local guides, up and down these paths. Sometimes you had to go up, up beds of streams and all. And we arrived, of course, carrying these vast great rucksacks that they'd be provided with 60 pounds of stuff inside them, mostly ammunition, very heavy. But, of course, the Burmese carried them. They didn't put them on their backs. They two of them slung one rucksack on a pole between them, which was been more sensible if we'd had that to begin with, probably. And then every night we spent a night in a village. The Karens live there. I think the Karens in the Piguemas are got them slightly separate from the other Karens. But they were very, very friendly. They were all American Baptists. They must have had missionaries there. And the leading headman, he'd always arrive and say he was a Christian, and he'd have a fountain pen in his shirt pocket there. That was one of the sort of badges of office. And they'd be frightfully friendly, and they'd put us in one of these huts, slept on the floor. They were mostly bamboo huts, you know, up on stilts. And they'd feed you. And I remember once they wanted to prepare supper, so they went out and had their chickens running around all outside. So he took his bow and arrow, and after three shots he managed to transfix one of his chickens, saved him running after it in the wood, I suppose, and made a very good curry with rice. They were very, very good at cooking rice, beautiful rice. They'd cook it so that there was no water left by the time they finished cooking it, very, very cleverly. And then after a week, I don't think many people can have been across these yomas, because it was quite a sort of effort, quite a stout effort, really. There was another team going with us, a very nice chap, was a major, John Harrington. Was he Welsh Guards or Grenadier Guards? Anyway, he'd been in Greece. You won't come across him now, because he died 2 years ago. But one of the nicest chaps ever, and educated in an adult chap, you know, very good. So that was about it, really. The guides were quite very good, but the Karens, they move their villages about every two or three years. They go in for this, I've got slash and burn, do you call it?
Shifting agriculture.
That's it. So that when you got to a stream, they knew that the village wasn't there. It would be either upstream or downstream. So that always caused a certain amount of consternation. Hugo Hood got very angry one time because he went the wrong way, or we went with it with the team, and he got a bit lost. And he said we'd all be court-martialed and this and that. It wasn't our fault. I think he was just, you know, got frightened. I mean, he got shaken up a bit. But he was a bit unpredictable. But that chap, Harrington, he was a very sort of sound chap and sort of brought calmness to us. So eventually we arrived at the other side, 2 or 3 miles back in the woods, east of the main road from Prome to Rangoon, I suppose it was. And then a little bit further west, there'd be the Irrawaddy, vast great river, the Irrawaddy. There we were in our wood. We set about it. We organized supply drops. We got them. We had elephants. I suppose they were all timber elephants. They were trained. They'd pick up the containers and move them around for us. Wonderful thing, an elephant. You can walk along a very, very narrow path. They all put their feet one behind the other. And we had oxen. And we had horses as well, ponies. And I forget which was frightened of which. I think the elephants were frightened of the horses or the oxen, one or the other. I mean, we never had to keep them separate. The elephants were allowed out with shackles on at night time in the jungle to feed themselves. We could never use them out on the plain. They got too hot, elephants. They must never be allowed to go out to the woods for too long in the midday. So we couldn't use them outside very much, except in the woods. And then I suppose we had some ambushes. I don't think I organized any ambushes.
But what kind of work were the elephants and the oxen doing?
Oh, I suppose they were moving these containers about, really, or moving. I don't know what else they were doing. I can't really remember. I spent a lot of time sending messages. We got a lot of intelligence, I suppose. How did we get it? I suppose they were doing little ambushes. I can't remember having been down to the main road on an ambush. I don't remember that. I was sent off. We had a message to say that there was a thing called Z-Force, whatever they were, away up to the north a bit, and would I go and contact them. So I went off on a pony. Took me all day riding up there. A very sore bottom if you ride in those great jungle greens all day, because our legs get very, very rubbed. Got there and met this Z Force. Not very impressive, really. They'd been given drugs of some kind. They were going to get information by giving people, I don't know what kind of drugs they had. Would that be hashish? I don't know. I'm not very up in drugs. But anyway, it struck me the time was that you wouldn't get very good information from people who were drug addicts, but that was what the bosses in England thought.
Why didn't Zeb Force impress you very much?
Because of this way they collected information. I thought you'd go around with a bag of drugs. It didn't seem a very cunning way of getting information. But I suppose partly jealousy. We thought that any other unit wasn't much good. Rather like in France, we had people called the SAS, which is a new, don't hear about them nowadays, but they went around in jeeps with twin Bren guns on the front, shooting everybody up. And that caused trouble, really, in the villages, because they rather woke the Germans up a bit too much, we thought. And, you know, there was a character in the American magazines then called Sad Sack, who was a sort of GI chap they had in their sort of strip cartoons. So we very scornfully called the SAS the sad athletic sacks. But that was only because we thought we were rather superior to them.
Did you see much of the SAS in France?
No, only that one lot we had coming through. Yeah. No. That was it, but I suppose, you know, you had your own little lot. We thought we were slightly more intelligent than any of that lot.
Were the Z Force British or Burmese or Koreans?
I think they were British. They must have had Burmese with them and all. The Koreans were very nice people. How many of the Burmese we had with us, I'm not sure. The priests were very suspect as being anti English. The Punjis they lived. And when we later on we went down onto the main road, they live in a thing called the Punji Chang, which is a vicarage place. And I think they always regarded them as much suspicion. But whether rightfully or not, I don't know. We sent back a lot of information as to what the Japs were doing. And how long were we there for, I don't know. Maybe in a couple of months, perhaps. And I can't remember really what we did every day. I really can't. I suppose we did something useful.
Did you keep free of disease?
Well, allegedly at the time, because we're on this Mepocrine, which suppresses malaria. In point of fact, it turned out later on no, but I didn't realise at the time. We were fine, really. We had a steam generator instead of a windy one. Well, that saved a lot of sweat. A little thing, rather like. You know, you put a fire under it, and it, I don't know how it worked. It had a bit of a boiler, you know, rather like a pressure cooker, I suppose, really. Because I know Jock Rawkers, who was a radio operator, he took the top off it too quick once, and he scalded all the back his hands and blistered them. And I thought, my God, now we're for it. I'll have to do the Morse code myself. However, we had some stuff, acroflavin jelly, which we were given for burns. I believe nowadays the doctors throw up their hands in horror. But anyway, I smeared this all over his hands, and he didn't have a blister. So that was a great mercy, really. So he was able to go on doing his da-da-da-da-da stuff. So that was all right.
Did you ever take any Japanese prisoners?
No. We saw a lot of dead Japanese. No, we didn't take any prisoners. No.
Who had killed the Japanese?
I think our lot somehow, yes, our lot. They were lying around. lying around the dishes, smelling rather nasty and sweetly, yes, rather unpleasant.
When you say our lot, you mean the British or
the Burmese, or that's right, Force 136 people, part of our little army. Not the Konkol Mamaki, can you very well? Konkol and Burmese National Army. It was whatever we were. Resistance. I don't know what we called ourselves.
Did you call them the Karen Levies?
No, I didn't call them anything, no. I don't know, really. I think they were nearly all Karens, but there were Burmese with them. And this, I suppose, allegedly they were communist-inspired. This man, San Tun, I suppose, was a communist. But for communists, I mean, you've got to read nationalist, really, I should think. You know, I mean, they didn't want to be ruled by China, for instance, I'm sure. But then, you see, then the whole thing, once you get the Americans into it, you call everybody a communist, and then he's, because he reads The Independent, and then that's how it is, isn't it?
Yes. What was the attitude of the Karens towards the Japanese?
I think they were very pro-British. Karens, they were very pro-English. Very pro-English, yeah. And why not, really? Because I think we looked after them quite well, probably. I think we looked after all the hill tribes quite well. I think it's quite disgraceful how we abandoned them all. Not only Karens, but I mean all the others.
But did the Karens hurt the Japanese?
I think they probably did. I can't see why they shouldn't.
Did you get drops of money?
No.
Did you get silver rupees dropped?
No, never did that. No, we didn't. No, we didn't buy our way at all. No, we were sent in with wads of phony rupees. Fake rupees we were given, but I brought them all back again. I mean, wads of money. What were we meant to do with them? I suppose we were meant to buy things, were we? Buy information, buy people. We didn't do any of that sort of thing. No. Wasn't necessary. Time we got there, you see, I mean, we were winning, weren't we?
Yes.
You know, and you see, you can't run a resistance movement if you aren't winning. That's one of the things they want to learn about a bit. Everybody wants to learn that. You couldn't have done much good in France if you weren't winning. Or you've got to be winning, haven't you?
So you didn't spend this money?
Oh, Lord, no, didn't spend a penny, no. No.
And you were there about 2 months, you said?
I think 2 or 3 months, yes. I don't know exactly.
From February?
Yes.
45.
I think so. You probably catch me out the other end when I filled in what I did afterwards. Got to fit it all in.
But did Japan surrender whilst you were there?
Oh, no. No. We were overrun by the army from the north. I think it was Indian army. I figure 20 sticks in my mind. Was it 20? Indian, 20 Indian, I think so, yes. They came down and overran us. I got arrested to begin with by them. I hadn't shaved, I had a beard, and they had what they thought I was. But anyway, they didn't arrest me for very long, I mean. I was searched to see if I had a knife on me. I think I was trying to see their boss, their commander, I suppose. And then they came through, and then... That's a thing that might be of interest to people in the future. The army was then, they talked about the two words, demob and repat. And there were two words that I'd never heard of. You would understand that. They got demob dates, and if they'd been out east for 2 years, 3 years, they'd get repatriated too. So once they came down, the army didn't want to go chasing any Japs at all, because that was a very dangerous period, really. That's the worst part, because we'd been living in the woods and the Japanese were on the roads, and then they had to reverse that, you see, and the Japanese had to get into the woods so they could nip off east, you know, get back home that way, you know, and we had to get on the roads. So we had a little worry then. We shot at each other as we were passing. And I was on an elephant, really, and the elephant lurched a bit, and all the acid in the battery of the transmitter thing. We had a battery with it as well as a. That all made holes in my trousers. It was rather painful.
And in the elephant?
That was about the elephant. A very thick skin, I think. Yes. But that was the sort of thing. So then we went down onto the main road. I think the place was called Okpo, O-K-P-O, O-H-P-O, I'm not quite sure. A little village there. And we were there for a few days. And I met up with this chap, Dave Britton, who I'd known, who'd been a Jed. And he had this idea that he must sort of win his spurs, you know. So he encouraged his troops, to his little band, to go off and chase the Japs across the fields. I think it was after I left, actually. And he got shot, of course, because I told you before, he was only been trained as AK-AK or something, or heavy AK-AK, I think. So that was a waste of a life, really. But the army, they didn't want to know, the regular army, whatever you know they are, they didn't want to go and chase anybody, because it was all demob and repat, and poor old so-and-so, you know, he got shot last night. He was due for demob next week, or repat next week, I mean, you know. So from a, that was, I don't know, from a morale point of view, I thought, if we hadn't gone out, we weren't winning the war, they'd be pretty serious, really, because you couldn't get anybody to do anything much.
They wanted to make sure they weren't shot in the last...
Yeah.
...11th hour.
Yeah, very wise, too, I think, you know. And then I got orders to go back to Rangoon. So I got in the truck, I was motoring along, I came to a river, and there was a bit of a Bailey bridge across it at an angle, because the main bridge was down. And I was stopped by a major in the Prevost Corps. That's like a military policeman. And he shouted at me, either put your hat on or take your shirt off, which confused me somewhat, because there was some rule they had. So we were a bit away from it all, really. We'd been in over 3 months. So anyway, I kind of talked to him a bit. It confused me so much that I ran the truck into the side of the girder sticking out across the bridge. However, it didn't really matter. And I talked to him, and he's quite a nice chap, and he said, you want to join the Prevost Corps, he said, much the safest place to be in. And then I got to Rangoon, and I suppose I must have been flown back, I suppose, to Calcutta, I think. And then Force 136, they had a rest house, at a very nice place, somebody's bungalow up at Kalimpong, which is near Darjeeling, a most beautiful place. And I felt rotten then. I spent 3 weeks there. I was very, very, very feeble, really, like I'd had malaria, really, and I had, you know, dysentery and this and that. However, after 3 weeks, I was all right. So then I caught the train down to Val Madras. I spent the night there. Back to Horana in Ceylon. And I spent about a week back in Ceylon. And then I had orders to go, this time as a liaison officer for Force 136, with the army, for the invasion of Malaya. So I was flown back up. I got to there, whether I went to Valcap.